Hello and welcome to Spectrum Iran. In tonight's show, we shall be focusing on the recent Iran naval drills. Stay with us. Welcome back. Iran wrapped up its naval drills on Wednesday, January the 2nd, having unveiled major achievements in various fields. Iran's Navy launched six-day naval drills on December 28, 2012, in order to display the country's capabilities in defending its maritime borders. Spokesperson for Iran's Velayat 91 naval drills, Rear Admiral Amir Rastegari, said the Islamic Republic is self-sufficient in electronic warfare equipment. Rastegari also announced that modern electronic warfare systems were tested on surface and subsurface vessels as well as air defense units during the last day of the Velayat 91 naval drills. In addition to unveiling advanced combat helicopter Tufan II, the Iranian Navy also successfully test-fired a range of indigenous missiles during the major military exercises. In tonight's edition of Spectrum Iran, we'll be looking at Iran's recent naval drills and try to shed light on the importance of these exercises in view of the threats being made against the country. And to help us to do so, we have the pleasure of being joined in our studio by Dr. Abu Mohammad Asgarkhani, Professor of International Relations at University of Tehran. Professor Asgarkhani, thank you for joining us, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I put the first question to Professor Asgarkhani, let's take a listen to our report about the naval exercises. Stay with us. The Iranian Navy successfully test-fired a range of indigenous missiles during its recent naval maneuvers. These included the surface-to-air missile RAD or Thunder, as well as a short-range cruise missile dubbed NASR or Victory. On Friday, December 28th, Iran's Navy launched a six-day naval maneuvers, codenamed Velayat 91, to display the country's capabilities in defending its maritime borders. Highly publicized Velayat 91 exercises took place across a wide area from the Strait of Hormuz, a vital oil and gas shipping route, to the Gulf of Oman and northern parts of the Indian Ocean. Over the past few years, Iran has held several military drills to enhance defensive capabilities of its armed forces and to test modern military tactics and equipment. The Islamic Republic of Iran has repeatedly assured other nations, especially its neighbors, that its military might poses no threat to other countries, insisting that its defense doctrine is based on deterrence. Welcome back. Professor Asgar-Khani, could you start by having your take on the recent six-day naval drills, particularly in view of the facts that the country is being threatened more or less on a regular basis?
Well, yes, theoretically, Iranian naval drill and maneuver is in line with defensive realism. It's not based on offensive realism. What does it mean? It means that the Iranian maneuver in the Persian Gulf is not going to threaten any other neighboring countries, mm-hmm. but it is based on defensive realism, which is based on the notion of the balance of power, mm-hmm. that to keep equilibrium and stability and security in the region. It is against, it's vis-a-vis the foreign aggression and foreign intrusion in the Persian Gulf, mm-hmm. Especially in our neighboring countries. So it's a tit-for-tat strategy. It is based on some kind of minimum defensive initiative, which is based on defensive deterrence, a minimum deterrence which is launched by Iranian forces. Mm-hmm. So given the fact that the American forces and the NATO forces and the foreign forces, especially in the Persian Gulf, Iran is de facto has been sandwiched by American forces. So this is a clear message for the United States and for the foreign powers in the Middle East that Iranian forces are able and willing to take care of the territorial integrity of the Persian Gulf and the Islamic Republic of Iran. Mm-hmm. So it is some kind of deterrence based on conventional weapons, that the indigenous missiles that Iran has developed is a clear message for foreign countries that it is based on minimum deterrence that Iran is giving this clear-cut message. It is not based on offensive realism. Based on offensive realism, the regional power, which is in the case of Iran as a regional power, might be inclined to exert its hegemony over the Middle East. But it is based on defensive realism, which is to say that Iran is capable of defending its own maritime borders and the sea borders recognized and very well established under international law.
Good. Professor Asgar-Khani, you just alluded to Iran being sandwiched by U.S. NATO forces, in a sense, U.S. forces, NATO forces in Afghanistan, in Turkey. We have the U.S. naval fleet in the Persian Gulf, in Bahrain. Can you just tell our viewers about the significance of all Iranian armed forces' combat readiness in view of the realities on the ground?
I think the foreign powers have already got the message. That was why some time ago they already proposed the idea of or the possibility of establishing a hotline between Iran and the United States, which means that, you know, they have got the message that Iran is capable enough to have a counter strategy against the strategy of the foreign powers. You see, the point is that possible intrusion or aggressive behavior by foreign powers recently are based on some kind of a maritime naval forces, mm-hmm. rather than land forces. On the land, the United States and foreign powers have proved to be not ready to have a very destructive force on the ground.
Vulnerable, they're vulnerable in a sense.
Well, yes. And the Air Force is very crucial in warfare, but that is not the decisive factor to, let's say, to bring a very final conclusion to the warfare.
That's right.
So the American approach and the foreign powers approach, as it has been established and it has been substantiated during the last decades, the strategy has been based on naval forces. The Americans have used cruise missiles and the missile technology from sea power, the United States and the United Kingdom. So the American strategy during the past decades have been based on conventional RMA forces, which means revolution in military affairs. The revolution in military affairs are based on three dimensions. The first one is the institutionalization of the war. The second one is the technology structure. And the third one is the accuracy of the targeting or data collecting information, and the accuracy of the targeting the military objectives. So the three dimensions of RMA were developed as of the Balkanization of the American strategy in the Balkans and later on in Iraq and Afghanistan. So Iranian maneuver is some kind of counter strategy against RMA. The strength of the RMA, as I put it, are technology structure, accuracy, and institutionalization. But the weakness of the RMA is in the asymmetric warfare,
which
they have proved to be ineffective in Afghanistan and even in Iraq and in every nook and cranny of the world that, you know, the United States tried to, for example, in Vietnam.
That's right.
So that is the weakness of the United States. So that's why, in order to compensate that weakness, the United States and the Western forces are using a maritime power, the sea power, that they are going to, let's say, to stay in the international waters, and from there
launch
their cruise missiles and target the military objectives at the heart of the enemy country. So the Iranian initiative to devise some kind of counter strategy against RMA was the Iranian maneuver in the Persian Gulf and the Iran naval drills, that it is some kind of indigenous technology developed by Iranian naval forces. So that is some kind of counter strategy against the Western strategy.
Thank you, Professor Asghar Khani. We witnessed during these 6-day naval exercises accomplishments being made by the Iranian forces. They unveiled various, as mentioned in our report, a range of indigenous missiles, be it short range, mid range, long range. We had RAD, a missile, Nasr, Qadir, Nur, we had cruise missiles unveiled. Capabilities being developed, and all of which have once again stressed Iran's independence. All these have come despite the sanctions. What is the message to the outside world, in particular the West and the US?
You see, the idea of the economic sanctions, which was developed by OFAC, the Treasury Department, and also was copied by the American friends like the United Kingdom and the EU,
some
European countries, was based on the idea that somehow to propagate and to have projection of wars on international mass media,
mm-hmm.
claiming that Iran is in material breach of the United Nations Charter. In order to show that the United States and the wording of the sanctions have tried to argue that Iran is after the WMD's weapons of mass destruction and in violation of human rights and sponsoring state terrorism in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these pretexts are certain accusations against Iran in order to pass further resolutions at the United Nations within the Security Council to say that Iran is in breach of the United Nations Charter. However, Iranian message is based on the balance of power. It is not based on, let's say, offensive realism in order to destabilize the Middle East. So the message of the sanctions were towards the vertical and also horizontal technology of Iranian indigenous technology. A close scrutiny of the vertical technology related sanctions show that they have tried to have embargo all of Iranian technology structure,
mm-hmm.
which could be used in any way to produce the Iranian missiles technology.
That's right.
But to the surprise of the United States and the Western powers, Iran, because it is based on techno-nationalism rather than international market, Iran has been able to institutionalize its own techno-nationalism. Techno-nationalism is based on technology and nationalism. Nationalism, conventionally, nationalism was based on only national aspirations, some kind of culture. Culture could be some kind of religion, language, custom, and those kind of things. But techno-nationalism is based on not only religion, language, custom, but also it is based on technology. Given the fact that we have been for the past 3 decades,
that's right.
We have been under
various kinds of
very, very restrictive rules of sanctions and embargo and boycott by the United States and Western power. So it has been based on some kind of need achievement of Iranian local technology. Based on need achievement, Iranian engineers and Iranian decision makers have been able to devise their own national technology. That is why I call it techno-nationalism.
Right.
Techno-nationalism means technology based on nationalism within given specific territory, based on history, geography,
culture.
Religion,
culture, pride of a nation.
So that kind of, you know, techno-nationalism specially justifies and also tells the story of the explosive technology of the Iranian, let's say, indigenous ambitions to provide its own technology based on, as I said, based on techno-nationalism. So in spite of the fact that Iran has been under pressure, not only because of the vertical technology economic sanctions, which they say vertical proliferation.
That's right.
And we have been under pressure on, let's say, horizontal proliferation. In spite of those, let's say, twin
pressures,
twin approach to let's say, economic pressure against Iran, Iran has moved towards its own need achievement. It was some kind of demand and supply. Security and also the strategy of survival was a driving force behind Iranian need achievement. So there was a demand for that within Iranian society. It could be used, let's say, under the rubric of culture, mm-hmm. or let's say sociobiology.
Right.
So within sociobiology, every species should learn how to survive. Given the
circumstances.
Very, very restrictive circumstances. So that was the story of the Iranian indigenous technology, which tells us how, based on need achievement, Iranian technology has proved to be, let's say,
so the sanctions,
successful.
In a sense, forced us to look within, to search within, in order, as you put it, to.
Well, it is a self-help strategy that, you know, when you deprive people of their own basic principles, basic survival of rights, so that every species, including all the, let's say, creatures, including man and the state, so they have no choice but to, let's say, to devise their own strategy of survival.
Hence, so the opportunities being seized upon in these circumstances.
Exactly, that's the way.
Thank you. We're going to give you a break, Professor Asghar-Khani. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Spectrum Iran. In tonight's show, we've invited Professor Abu Mohammad Asghar-Khani, political analyst, expert, professor of international relations at the University of Tehran, to come and shed some light on the recent Iran Navy exercises and the broader picture of its message to regional countries and those afar. Professor Asghar-Khani, earlier, sir, you mentioned the fact that these exercises and the others having been staged in Iran are based on the country's minimum defensive initiative. that the Iranian doctrine is defensive, it's not aggressive, it's not offensive. And also you also alluded to the fact that the West, the US, has in a sense recognized, it acknowledges Iran's power, hence the request to establish a hotline between the country. Iran maintains the message of these, all these exercises have been message of peace, security for the region, the, particularly the Persian Gulf, littoral state. Why is it that some of these countries don't get this message?
Actually, all the societies of the Persian Gulf region have got the message. I mean, we have a lot of commonality between, let's say, the people who live in our neighboring countries. We are Muslims, and we have same historical background in terms of culture, custom, and the way of life. We have no problem with them. However, it is true that the certain dictators of the societies, they are very much dependent on foreign powers. So that is the foreign powers, let's say, aggressive behavior and their intrusive means, and also their intervention, illegal intervention in the region, is the cause of the problem. So I mean, it is the head of the states that, under immense pressure by great powers, that they say that Iran is a threat. But actually, when we talk to the people of the region, on let's say on society to society level, we don't witness any problem with the people. The popular movement in the region, as we see, is based on some common ideology, common values, and common norms and behavior. However, when it is politicized by the dictators of the region, mm-hmm. when it is politicized by the great powers, actually they are acting in the interest of the great powers. That is the root of the problem. What we argue is that please leave the region alone, and the region is replete with foreign forces, while the people of the region, they would like to see a region bedrift of the foreign powers. That is the problem of the region. And I think the people have got the message, but the decision makers at the top of certain countries, they are very much, inclined to see great powers in order to take care of the material incentives of the great powers. For example, in terms of energy, petroleum, and also gas. See how many international, multinational corporations are involved in the region. When, for example, one American fleet steps into the Persian Gulf.
That's right.
Can you imagine how many other private companies and multinational corporations, they come to the region? And what are the economic and security consequences of so many forces?
That's right, the ramifications.
As you see, the fifth fleet of the American Naval Force in Bahrain, they have
personnel, thousands.
Personnel and cooks, 300 cooks.
They just 300 there. Cooks to,
yes, they,
to cater for them.
Yes, and how many personnel for that? So, and they together, they bring a number of, let's say, forces and private companies. For example, when a oil drilling company comes to the Persian Gulf, to the Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or Qatar, each oil drilling company brings with itself a number of service companies in order to cater for them.
Mm-hmm.
So they need that kind of intrusion. So the influx of foreign forces in the Middle East will bring with itself a number of, let's say, repercussions and implications, including social implications, economic implications, and also inflation to the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the problem. That I mean, when we speak of the possibility of giving a clear-cut message, you know, we are a member of the Islamic organization. So we talk to them on a bilateral basis, multilateral basis. So we don't have any problem with them when come to, let's say, bilateral negotiations or multilateral negotiations with the people. But when it comes to, let's say, to foreign intervention in the country, in the Middle East, especially, that is the cause of the problem.
Dr. Asghar-Khani, there is little Western media coverage of true developments in the country, be it scientific, medical, military, as in the case of the recent naval exercises. Why this chicanery, sir? Why is it that they never reflect the truth, in a sense?
Well, they would like to mitigate Iranian indigenous power in this regard. Because what is going to happen if if a true picture of Iranian capability is displayed on international mass media,
mm-hmm.
so it's going to have its own, let's say, deterrence on the international level. So that is the strategy of the world mass media in order to downgrade, in order to, let's say, mitigate, to not to, let's say, I'm not saying that, you know, they must exaggerate this, but the true picture is not reflected on the international mass media. To what extent, for example, Iran has been able to develop its nanotechnology, to what extent we have been able to fly beyond, let's say, outer space,
mm-hmm.
our satellite.
Satellite, that's right.
And to what extent we have been able to establish petrochemical companies. Prior to the revolution, we had just a couple of only petrochemical company, but look at now at the let's say Asalouye and the Persian Gulf.
South.
So we have a number of, you know, capability petrochemical companies, and so it is some kind of, you know, self-help system that they wouldn't like to argue, or at least to show that Iranian revolution based on self-help system has been successful. Iran started in the beginning by some kind of import substitution strategy.
That's right.
And our current policy of economic resistance is some kind of self-sufficiency strategy that Iran,
even in the face of foreign
sanctions against Iran, yes, that is a true picture of what is happening. So actually we have been able to rely upon our own means of survival in every aspect of life.
Thank you Dr. Asghar-Khani. We're going to give you another breather. We'll be back after this short break. Stay with us. Welcome back. Professor Asghar-Khani, Prior to the end of the drill, one or two on the fourth day, if I'm not mistaken, Iranian Navy said it had stopped over 30 intrusion attempts by foreign spy drones and reconnaissance plane. So we don't know what the final count would be at the end of the 6 days of the exercises. Does it surprise you that foreign forces, especially the US forces, were so keenly following the developments in the Persian Gulf, particularly these naval drills?
Well, they're studying our forces. It is true that Iran was the first country, let's say all over the world, was the first country was able to bring down the US drone. And it was a very big surprise. I mean, second to none on the international level when we talk about it. Mm-hmm. And for some time, the United States was silent over that. But the international mass media had no choice but to report that Iran has been able to bring down a US drone. So it means that Iran has been able to have access to the technology, to, let's say, to cyber power and the reconnaissance system of the United States has been, you know, has been given a very, very stunning blow for the first time.
Dr. Asiakhani, we've got about over 2 minutes left, so tell us about the importance of vigilance at a time when certain countries are fueling sectarian flame in the region, in the Middle East. We're seeing that, witnessing that in Syria, and unfortunately more recently in Iraq.
Well, what is happening in the Middle East, especially in Syria and Iraq, it is some kind of double standard approach by Western powers. Elsewhere, I have tried to argue that it is based on some kind of deontology and consequentialism. It is biased and it is based on double standard in the sense that, for example, in certain countries, when the United States and the foreign powers, they talk of foreign intervention, mm-hmm. they base their own strategy, they base it on the ontology and the ethics of the philosophy that, for example, in the case of Bahrain, that they say that what is happening in Bahrain is based on the ontology, which means that it is based on cause and effect relationship. And what is happening in Bahrain, they say that it's some kind of terrorism or terrorist activities. But what is happening in Syria, they argue that it is based on consequentialism, that it is, they would argue that sometime in the future, if Bashar Assad and the Alawi system remains in power in Syria, they are going to be, let's say, to have crucial consequences for the regional security. Mm-hmm. So what they are doing in Syria and recently in Iraq, it is based on consequentialism, which is, to my own understanding, is some kind of illegal interpretation of
Thank
the case.
Thank you. Well, with those comments, it's time to bring this edition of Spectrum Iran to an end. Special thanks to our special guest for his time and insight. We had the pleasure of being joined on the program by political expert Dr. Abu Mohammad Asiakhani, Professor of International Relations at the University of Tehran. Dr. Asiakhani, it was a pleasure to have you join our program.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Thank you. And that's a wrap for this edition of Spectrum Iran. I'd like to thank our viewers for staying tuned. A goodbye and God bless.